And now we're going to explore the afterlife, the last frontier with Dr. Julia Asante. I'm looking forward to this, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And if you're following us on Twitter, we've got one of our hashtags up on the afterlife, asking people to tweet and tell us what you think happens after death. And you're going to enjoy that because Lex resends them, and a lot of you can participate together on that. We call it hashtag, and it's at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Julia Asante is a mystic, a scholar, highly gifted professional, intuitive, almost four decades of experience with the afterlife. Her accuracy scores from clinical tests on telepathy, remote viewing, conducted at Columbia University back in 1987, simply went off the charts. We're talking about her work, The Last Frontier. Julia, how are you?
Great, George. Thanks so much for allowing me on the show. It's a wonderful pleasure.
Great topic, and you did a wonderful job with your book, The Last Frontier, and the foreword written by a friend of ours, Larry Dossey. So I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you.
Tell me how you started into all this. What happened to you?
Well, I think I was born into it. I was born in a time when my mother was in powerful mourning from the death of her infant son and her father. I think that that intense grief affected me greatly in the prenatal as well. But when you become a professional intuitive, you're always chatting with the dead. It always happens. In 1983, however, a friend of mine, she was somewhere between a patient and a friend, died. And that was the first time, really, that I spent days helping somebody who was not transiting well. And that experience, those 3 days spent with her, trying to get her to get over her denial of death, primarily, changed my whole attitude of what was going on in the afterlife.
How did you help her do that?
Primarily by staying in trance. I'm not to say that I stayed in trance all day, but I checked in on her several times a day. And she was not prepared to die. People were always expecting a miracle, even though her cancer had gone into the brain already. These kinds of false expectations are often detrimental to people when they pass over. And she had left two little boys behind and was worried about them because no one had bothered to talk to her about what was going to happen after she died, because no one mentioned the fact that she was dying.
That's a topic people don't like to talk to the dying about, is it?
Yes. And what is so strange about our society is that it's a taboo topic when it's real, but we have a schizophrenic relationship in that if you look at tonight's TV programs or the news or whatever, it's a nonstop gruesome death.
That's true.
Yep.
It just doesn't end.
No.
Most people, I think, are afraid of dying. Not that we want to check out early, but they're afraid of dying. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think the fear of death is actually running the modern world, and it's being exploited by institutions and industries. Certainly, the fear of death has been cultivated by institutional religions. But still, since then, you have science, you have medicine, you have pharmaceuticals, insurance companies, war industries. Almost anything you can name, even the way we teach history, conveys messages of a dangerous universe, the body is a time bomb, and death is a failure. We're surrounded by it.
Julia, when people talk with you about death, what do you talk to them about? I mean, how do you comfort somebody?
Oh, that's case by case. It depends on where they are. Most of the time, I try to, first of all, I don't give them any specific expectations. That's probably the worst thing you can do, that they're going to meet so-and-so or feel the presence of God or anything of that sort. But I do talk to them about what the research is and what my experience is in terms of the afterlife, especially the sense of total freedom, of wholeness, and this sense of a kind of luminous presence that's very supportive and loving and knowing.
Do you find, Julia, that the person who's about to die will listen to you, or are they, you know, off on that other plane already?
Yeah, that's exactly right, George. Usually, if they have made peace with death, if they start to welcome it, which they do, the reason they don't talk about it is to protect the people around them who are still uncomfortable with it. But if you start talking to them about it when they've made peace with it, they usually sort of already know. They felt it already. There's a portal that seems to open, and people around feel it. I don't know if you must have at this point been in a deathbed, and you feel a kind of a magic. The moment seems to expand. Miracles seem to happen. Coincidences, so-called coincidences that seem almost impossible. This is all this kind of magic that surrounds death, in my view.
And Julie, is death like the dream state? You know, yeah. How you have a dream and you wake up and you go, oh, that was a pretty good dream. Is it that way? And you say no.
In a sense, yeah, in that they both take place in non-physical realities. But I would say that dreams are often more chaotic and they're more symbolic. Yes, much more so. And the after-death state, you can't really say that there is a one specific after-death state. There's certainly not. For each person, it's different, and for each culture, cultures actually influence what happens after death, too.
Why do some departed souls hang around? Why don't they just move on to wherever they're supposed to go?
Most of the time, it's unfinished business, lack of reconciliation with someone, or they're protecting someone. A child might stay close to a living parent. A dead parent might stay close to a young child.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of reasons. Other reasons that are not quite so positive are poor preparation, false expectations, denial of being dead, especially in situations of accidental death by, say, drug overdose.
Well, this denial of death, I mean, at what point do they realize there's something wrong here? Nobody's talking to me. I'm not eating. I don't feel hungry. I mean, did they ever get to that point where they just say, "I think I'm dead"?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of help on both sides of the veil. But there, just want to relate a short story to you about a man who had gone to a medium. And they brought in this guy, some lieutenant from World War II, and this is about in the late, I think early 70s or something, this seance took place. And this guy in World War II was the dead guy in World War II, was the friend of the person who had gone to the medium. And he's screaming at his friend, "Why aren't you here on the battlefield with me?" Oh, so for some, 30 years, he thinks he's in the same battle. So what I'm trying to say is that their sense of time is different. I think for the dead person who experienced himself still on the battlefield in World War II, he must have experienced himself there for a matter of a day or 2 days, not several decades. So it depends, really. The answer to that is not so simple. But most of the time, there's help either from the other side or from this side to help people realize their condition. In most cases, it's immediate recognition.
At the moment of death, Julia,
yeah.
Is the person so weak that he doesn't think about death? It just happens? Or do they have this moment where, you know, the heart is racing and they just know something's going to happen, that it could either be the end or the beginning of the end, but they're just not sure?
Right. Again, I keep saying that you can't make big generalizations, or I won't anyway, but one of the things that we can say is that a number of many, many people have what we call nearing death awareness towards the end of life, especially if the illness has been longstanding. And at that time, two things happen. Major visions happen on the deathbed. One is the people who have already died, friends and relatives of the dying person, come. And the second is the vision of the afterlife. And so that they do the dying do see it coming. Very often they'll say, like Steve Jobs, "Oh wow, oh wow, oh wow," were his last words, because you see, actually see the afterlife opening up before their
eyes. Yeah.
So there is that. And there's also a feeling of impatience, of wanting to die. Very often the dying will tell you exactly when they're dying, if you listen. So I think there's a lot of awareness of letting go into that realm.
Is it instant when they die? I mean, does everything just go black and then they transform to the other side?
No. Again, that depends on the person. And sometimes there's a lot of indecision. There's a lot of floating out of the body and then back in again, especially if there are resuscitations involved. There's one quotation, though, from a father, a dead father, who said to his daughter, I just love this. He said to his daughter, "Dying, honey, it's as easy as falling off a log."
You know what? He's probably right.
Yeah. I think in traditional societies, that's how they looked at it. They looked at dying as something where you just slipped out of your body into a better world.
How come science doesn't try to definitively prove that there is life after death?
Well, since the atomic age, science has very strongly positioned itself against religion. And the linchpin of religion is, of course, an afterlife. Before World War II, there were a lot of scientists who were involved in afterlife studies. And if a scientist said that he or she did not believe in an afterlife, that was tantamount to saying, "I'm not Christian. I don't believe in the resurrection." Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't done until the atomic age. Scientists started to take a more materialist view of the universe. So that's one thing, but really, scientists know that it's not so much of a materialist universe, so it's not really a good excuse. But nevertheless, the ideology is in place. Scientists who do want to do afterlife research are ridiculed. They have the threat of losing their positions and whatever funding they live on. So it's a big risk, too big to take at this point.
Julia, where do demons fit in here?
Well, they're, you know, in the extreme antiquity, demons very often were protective. So the notion of a satanic force actually is quite late, probably around the 5th century BC, of a pure satanic force. There were always, you know, bad forces in, say, ancient Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt, but easily to handle. It was only later where you started getting these big guys, these satanic types, who seemed to have an army of demons. For myself, I have no belief whatsoever in evil. And I have, in the course of my psychic career, have done a number of exorcisms. I've never found anyone possessed by evil. I've only found people who believe they're evil. And that can, believe me, can just open up all kinds of abilities that their nicer selves wouldn't allow.
So you do not believe in a heaven and hell?
No, oh no, no, no. The for me, and for all that the evidence we have shows, forgiveness is the number one rule. And hell, you see it, you can see it. I've known people who've stayed in self-made illusions of hell. This is a purely personal setup. It is designed to punish themselves or to perhaps bring on a catharsis of moving through the so-called evil self and being saved into salvation.
Is it wrong for people to want to live as long as they can, even if they're in their 80s and 90s?
No. But you know, we do have this attitude that in all cases life is superior to death, and so that sometimes even when life is so devalued and there's no, and the body is worn out, we still won't give into it. And this is really about fear. So if you're wanting to live as long as possible because you're afraid of what's to come, that's something else. But if you're wanting to live long as possible because you're still living a robust life and it's, you know, it still has value for you and you're still growing, fine, great. My feeling is that if we do ditch the fear of death, we will live longer and we will live more robustly with more purpose.
I think so too.
Yeah, thank you.
No question about that.
Great.
Most scientists don't believe in the afterlife. Most people who are spiritual do.
Right.
Why can't they meet in the middle ground here?
Well, it's starting to happen, I think. Again, there's this opposition between religious, spiritual, and science materialism. But it's starting to happen. It's coming in sort of by the back door, in a way, with these consciousness studies and non-local reality and investigations of time. And science is also pretty well set up for it. It seems to be skirting around the issue of the afterlife, but in the same time, it's creating things like multiverses, you know, where there's a near infinite amount of dimensions, exactly like our own, or not quite, that originate from, for every electron movement, another universe splits away. So it's almost an infinite number of them. So they have a lot of ideas that approximate the afterlife. They just won't touch it because of it. It's tainted by religion.
Julia, where does consciousness fit into all of this?
Oh, the whole thing is about that. Absolutely. Consciousness is something that we are. The soul, I don't like it, like the word soul so much, because the soul is something that you become once you lose your body. But consciousness is what we are. How we live is largely a byproduct of our consciousness. It creates our reality. The same thing happens in the afterlife. Your afterlife reality is also created by your consciousness. So you bring building blocks, or things that are familiar to you, things that you love from the life that you've left, into the afterlife. And also mass consciousness plays a role in it. The consciousness is the whole thing. I mean, that's really all there is. And out of that springs matter.
And are we dealing with a form of energy which probably was around maybe even before the formation of the universe?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think, yes, I think the Higgs is just many steps away from the actual nuts and bolts of consciousness and how it operates, probably through a kind of an electrical conveyor belt. As far as I can see now, it's something I'm looking into.
How do you convince somebody about the afterlife and about not being scared?
Oh, well, I like to look at some of the more interesting things about near-death experiences, in that when a person's body is shut down, the person's brain is shut down, the person's heart is shut down, everything's flatlining. And this can go on even for a day. A body can also be cold. That a person's consciousness not only operates outside of matter, but operates far, far better with greatly enhanced skills and perceptual skills. That alone tells you something about the relationship with consciousness and matter. That consciousness, in terms of like a near-death experience with people who are congenitally blind from birth, have never had a dream even of light or of color. And when they get out of their bodies, they can see.
They can see. Stay with us, Julia. We're coming back. We're going to talk more about The Last Frontier. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we will flip the switch and take your phone calls with Julia Asante as we talk about The Last Frontier, exploring the afterlife and transforming our fear of death. I've got a few questions for her, though, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we go. Julia Asante with us as we talk about The Last Frontier. I love that title, by the way. It's so apropos, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
When you were doing those tests at Columbia University, I mean, how did you knock this thing off the charts? What happened? What'd they do?
Well, they put one person in another building, and they attached me to all sorts of biofeedback equipment, which actually didn't work. And I was to read the other person's mind and also to see what that person saw.
And
I couldn't shut up. I just went on and on and on. I was getting subconscious thoughts. Even an hour after the testing, I was still coming up with information. So I was tested against other psychics, and I was in my own category. Pretty neat. I was floored.
And do you get better? Are you still getting better?
Yes, actually, I'm getting. I think I'm getting to know my sources better. How to call on them, how to pull them in. Certainly, the after-death communication stuff is becoming spectacular. I've had some readings where I've had two dead people show up and an unborn person, and the unborn person, the one soon to be born, can actually dominate a session. And when I teach it now, too, so far, no one has not had, is that right, what I just said? Everyone has had an after-death experience when I teach it.
No one has not. You can't say two negatives
exactly,
in the same sentence.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, thank you.
I get caught on that once in a while, too. With evil, you said that you don't accept evil.
No.
Right? But what about the serial killer, the person who commits horrendous crimes in their physical life? I mean, what happens to the scoundrel when they die?
Oh, you know, in some cases they die with tremendous remorse. In some cases they don't. Many, many years ago, I worked with a serial killer and who was alive, and I was able to access his greater self, just believing that he had one, and asking to make a mistake.
I assume he was in prison when you were working.
No, he wasn't. He was on the loose, and he hadn't been found.
Oh, my.
And he was, and I asked him to make a mistake, and in broad daylight, he was caught stealing a car.
Yeah. And that's how they nailed him.
Yeah. So there's good in everyone. Really, there is. And if you ask any prison warden what's going on with people in prison, it's from punishment from childhood, rejection, hatred, brutality.
Oh, there's no doubt.
So that's what makes evil.
When you told the serial killer to make a mistake, did you do it via telepathy?
Yes, absolutely. And I can feel when I'm locked in. That's the point.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
How do you know that you're reaching that individual?
It's a feeling, and I teach this too with people doing after-death communication. It's almost like two lenses clicking into place. It's the same way, George, if, you know, you can be talking to somebody and they're even responding, but you know they're not really connected to you. They're not really,
right.
You know. And then that moment when that shifts and they start really listening, you can feel it.
It clicks in.
Yep, exactly.
And you're in the groove and off you go.
Off you go.
But you just don't believe in the evil end of it. That is the one thing I have a difficult time understanding.
Why?
I just feel as if there's got to be a place for the good people. There's got to be a place for the bad.
Why?
Do these bad people, you believe in reincarnation, I assume, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do these bad people keep reincarnating until they get good?
I'm not a big advocate of this, the spiritual evolution theories, because this is all happening in a non-time situation.
So will a murderer come back as a murderer?
Or murdered. Yeah. I mean, a murderer can explore different aspects of the same thing, or become a criminologist, or have nothing to do with that scene whatsoever. But the point is that we are all from the divine. All of us. Our basic selves are divine. And given that, there can not really be any absolute evil.
Is punishment part of organized religion?
Absolutely. In fact, systems of punishment for the afterlife are quite late. Earlier systems that come from more traditional style religions, in that the afterlife was not taken over by institutions, everybody went to an afterlife. Everybody had an eternity, no matter what they did in their life. There wasn't any sense of morality. There wasn't any concept of sin. The whole idea of sin is really, really new. That's about maybe 5th, 6th century B.C. And that's when you start to get these concepts of condemnation and torture and whatnot. You start to see it in what Middle Kingdom Egypt. I know that probably doesn't mean much to you, but this idea of the feather test, where the morality of the soul is weighed against the feather, and if the the dead person doesn't pass the feather test. He doesn't enter into eternity. But these are quite late systems. Earlier ones in traditional societies all over the world, such as the Native American Indian, everybody goes to the afterlife.
Does the person who
similar to the life the world that you know? Sorry.
Does the person who does not fear death, like a war hero, let's say, you know, he'll go doing anything to protect his own members of his unit, because he doesn't fear death. Do those people have an upper hand in life? Those people who just don't fear death, and they live, I assume they live pretty good.
Well, I would think that a war hero has some kind of strange relationship with the fear of death, and therefore is always trying to combat the fear. But if you look at people who genuinely don't have any fear of death, you're looking at something that seems like a different species of human, a different type of human. These people, especially after near-death experiences, have significant changes in that even their intelligence quotient rises, their creativity rises, their psychic ability rises. They have much more sensitivity to the environment. They give up the idea of competition. They just don't care about it. They don't care about what people think of them. They want more knowledge, learning, and they want to do service. And they live with a stronger sense of purpose without the fear of death. So that's a lot of change.
What would you say about a person, for example, let's say two people are out having dinner and some gunman bursts in and he's ready to fire on everybody. And one person literally covers the other person with his body to protect that other person. Probably, I would assume, is not even thinking of death, or maybe they are. I don't know. What do you think?
I think when you're in a stress situation, sometimes, very often, this is not true that it's sometimes, very often, you go into a state of extreme expansion. And when you're in that state of extreme expansion, your life against another person's life doesn't mean anything. In other words, you're perfectly willing to give your life up for someone else. I've been there. I know what that's like. I'd be perfectly willing to throw myself in front of a car to protect somebody.
You would. Would you take a bullet if you
Oh, absolutely. When you're in that state, that's exactly what you'll do.
Yeah.
Because somehow in that state, you understand the survival. You understand eternity. You understand you're immortal, and you switch into a kind of extreme altruism. It's a beautiful thing, that state, and it can be triggered by stress, as all spiritual states can, such as near-death experience.
Would you be in shock if you were wrong about the afterlife?
I would certainly, yeah. I think I would go with the flow. But, you know, I think the evidence is kind of in at this point. There are many tens of thousands of after-death communications that are published or collected, and they're all more or less giving the same kind of story as our near-death experiencers, and it's coming together nicely. A very different view of the afterlife than we've had until now.
Either the brain does some very strange things at the moment of death, or there's something to it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I would rather think that there is something to it.
Oh, yeah. In after-death communication, it can't be imagination. It simply can't. Imagination of the recipient will not heal them. It will not reconcile things. It will not warn them about a danger. We have a new kind of therapy out called induced after-death communication therapy, which induces after-death communication. And when the pertinent dead come in, it can clear up post-traumatic stress disorder in a matter of seconds. And that's not imagination. Something real is happening. That's how we know anything in science. Without direct observation, if something real is happening, there must be something real to the event. There's a real effect.
You think the person who believes in life after death is generally happier?
Yes. Although I've known some very happy atheists, and they just really want to live life to the fullest, and I believe they'll be very happy when they die, too. Surprised and happy.
Will they be confused when they die?
If it's an angry kind of atheist, it's likely. If it's a kind of atheism that is proving a point or is coming out of anger but not real belief, any state of mind that you die with can affect what happens to you after that.
Where do you put angels into any of this?
They're
if
there.
You do. Okay.
Yeah. I've never seen any with wings, but they are magnificent.
You cite a number of stories in The Last Frontier. You mentioned one of them. Give me another one of your examples on somebody who might not have believed in life after death, but got their minds changed.
Excuse me?
That they changed their minds afterward.
Okay. A friend of mine died. His best friend was an atheist, didn't believe in any of this. And I was talking to her. She was on the streets of Paris. We were in a noisy street. And suddenly I started channeling her dead friend. And what happens to me is that I feel this sort of electric current go through me. I call it the tingling.
Mm-hmm.
And it really can take me over. And I held her hands on the street corner while I was saying goodbye to her. And she was feeling this coming through her body. And her eyes swelled with tears. And she said, "Julia, what's happening to me? What's happening to me?" And I said, "It's Gustav, the dead person. He's here to say thank you." And she wept and wept on the corner. Well, since then, Gustav and she have been having a lot of discussions, and has completely changed her life. He was an artist, Gustav, and she has just recently had her first exhibition in Paris.
How about that?
Yeah.
Do young people generally communicate with the departed?
Yes, absolutely. And they die much, much more easily, much more beautifully than adults.
And the parents generally try to negate that?
Yeah.
Put the kid down?
That's so true. That's where it all starts. Same thing with reincarnational memory. It all starts with censure.
Well, you started young. Did your parents try to censor you, try to stop you?
Sure.
Oh, they did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was punished for my reincarnational memories.
What did you do? Just tell them?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was dumb enough to do that.
Would you recommend that people just keep these things to themselves?
No. Not at all. All this has to come out. The more we repress it, the more difficult everything gets. And we've already lost way too much communication with the inner self, with the development of the ego. And I don't have any real grief against the ego, mind you, but it's just taken over. The idea, the ego being the idea, the function that says that only what you perceive through your physical senses is real. That's what I mean by the ego.
Does the other side, Julia, have a look to it? Something you can describe, something tangible?
Well, it's not a place.
Not a
right?
place. They're no. not clouds in the sky.
Yeah, it can. I mean, if that's the way you imagine it, it can. It can look cosmic. It can look like gardens. It can look like a seascape. It can look like just
anything,
a luminous
anything
presence.
You want?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can reconstruct houses from your childhood, but it doesn't mean that's where you're staying all the time. That's just one of the places that you have that you can reconstruct from your life that gives you a certain amount of comfort or furthers you along in your self-fulfillment.
Sort of reminds me of the Robin Williams movie, What Dreams May Come.
Yeah, it got close to it, except then they put all that dramatic hellish stuff in, you know, to make it into a real movie.
Stepping on those people's faces.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. Yeah. Unforgettable scene.
What do you recommend for people if they want to get into this kind of groove, if they want to, you know, be a little more receptive? What do they do? Meditate? What's out there?
Well, if you're talking about becoming more receptive to after-death communication.
Yeah.
Okay. Notice how often you have it, because we all do. Look for times when thoughts spring into your head that don't seem to belong to you. Music springing into your head, especially the lyrics, maybe giving you a message, or when space seems disturbed, when you're just feeling a presence or you smell something, sometimes you'll hear things, or you feel this tingling that I was just talking about. Go still. Go still and close your eyes and look inside and look for images, any sort of images or words or messages, and just be still and speak out loud and say, I feel you, I hear you, and I'm ready, and see what happens.
What do you tell someone who is grief-stricken?
Well, you know,
that's got to be
you know, you're just talking about the Robin Williams movie.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they really had right was that every time Robin, was it that movie? I might be confused here. When one of them showed up, the dead person showed up, the other one started crying. Wasn't that in that movie?
Was that Ghost?
That was also in Ghost, but I think it was also in the Robin Williams. In any case.
It might have been in that.
Yeah. What I call it is I call that a grief wave. When you're suddenly overcome by grief, very often that's because of the presence of the person you're grieving for. The association is just too strong. So if you're feeling strong grief, go in, and even if you're crying, using your strongest emotion, proceeding from your strongest emotion, begin talking out loud. Because grief usually signifies, a strong surge of grief usually signifies a presence. Another thing that's really, really important is a lot of the horrors of surviving the death of a loved one is remembering the last moment. The mangled mm-hmm. body, if it was a car accident, or...
Or maybe you didn't get a chance to see them or talk
right.
to them.
That's right. But let's just stay with this. The last images, the last memory that's so painful and intrude. When that happens, try to see them as they are now. Try to see them as they are whole, in the prime of their lives, and know that from their perspective, whatever it was that killed them really is not that significant anymore. That's really what's important. They're fine. They're doing great. And try to contact them on that basis, as they are now, not as you remember them last. That's really, really important.
Julia, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take phone calls with you in our final hour. Julia's website, it's just her name, juliaasante.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And we're talking about her work, The Last Frontier, Exploring the Afterlife and Transforming Our Fear of Death. Amazing series of stories and research. We'll be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.